Bank versus Upman, and Justice Hobbs is not participating in this case. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Brown. With me is Mr. Walker and Mr. Koshal. It is an honor to appear before this court. The issue here is, how do you renew a judgment lien based on a foreign judgment? We believe the trial court, Judge Ockhorn, got the decision correct by looking at 1352-102 and determining that in order to extend a judgment lien, you need to revive the judgment. In that statute, it says you go to the court where the judgment was entered, and you revive that judgment, and you record a transfer to judgment in the county, thus renewing the judgment lien. Respondents argue that that was improper, that in fact you needed a transfer to judgment from Colorado to renew that judgment lien. I think the Court of Appeals, in reversing the trial court, got it wrong and further muddied up the waters in this area. There's an interplay between the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act and enforcement of judgments in Colorado. And I think it's in that interplay where the Court of Appeals got confused. I think there are inconsistencies in the law, and I think this is an opportunity for this court to clear it up. To understand this issue, I think looking at the Uniform, as I will call it, the Uniform Act is important. The Uniform Act was passed to simplify and to streamline enforcement of foreign judgments in the state of Colorado. Prior to the Act, the way you would take a judgment is you would come into the state of Colorado with a foreign judgment and you'd bring an entire new action. You'd bring a new action, you'd serve process, and a new judgment would be entered in the state of Colorado. The Uniform Act said, we're going to streamline this. What we're going to do is we're not going to make you do that. We're going to honor the foreign judgment. We're going to recognize that due process was given in that foreign judgment. We're going to allow you to come in, and you're going to be able to enforce that foreign judgment as if it was a Colorado judgment. And the way you're going to have to do this, you simply file it, you send out a notice, and you proceed. Why this is important is because I think this issue of how you renew a judgment lien goes down to the issue of what do we have here in Colorado when you domesticate a judgment. Do you have two judgments or do you have one? I believe the wording of 1352-102 in the Baum case states you have one judgment. You have the foreign judgment of Arizona, which is being recognized in the state of Colorado for purposes of enforcement. I think 1352-102 was clear that it was going to make a distinction between filed and entered. As you will note in the reading of the statute, when it talks about the domestication of the foreign judgment, it talks about that the foreign judgment is filed in the state of Colorado, and then once it's filed, it is going to be enforced as a Colorado judgment. It's not a new judgment being entered. So Baum saw that distinction. Baum said, "Hey, we have a New York judgment that's trying to be enforced in the state of Colorado. We need to go back to where the judgment was entered." They didn't say go back to where it was domesticated. They didn't say go back to the Colorado domestication procedure. They said we need to go back to where the judgment was entered. And that's in fact what happened in this case.
Mr. Brown?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question? I don't know, maybe I feel a little oversimplistic here, but it seems like there's a split in the cases. It also seems like the statute is not exactly helpful. And you both have made very, I think, excellent arguments concerning statutory construction, which leave me somewhat befuddled. But why are you really taking the position that you don't have to comply with Rule 54H to revive a lien, but not, I mean, to execute on a judgment and get your lien, rather than to revive and not necessary to revive it? I mean, I don't understand why there is a different procedure for one as opposed to the other. And I recognize that you can make some very good arguments about statute, and the other side can as well.
I think that is a good point. And I think it goes back to our theme in that Wells Fargo, and that's who Ms. Kaufman bought this position from, had the law that was before it at the time and complied with it as best it could understand. There are inconsistencies. 54H is one such example. It has a process.
Well, why wouldn't you comply with, why isn't it reasonable to expect that?
Because it's not.
You did it before, so you have to do it again.
Because it's not a Colorado judgment. It's a foreign judgment being enforced in the state of Colorado. 54H talks about revival of Colorado judgment. And when you look at 54H, which predated the Uniform Act, by the way, so it didn't contemplate the new act coming into place. If you look at the Uniform Act, it provided for a streamline. So the streamline is we're not going to have new process. We're not going to necessarily have a hearing. We're just going to simply file, and we're going to send notice out. So if, in fact, that is the purpose of the Uniform Act to streamline, why would we then go back into Colorado procedures and how to revive an Arizona judgment? And why would we follow procedures in Colorado which are more stringent than what it was to domesticate the judgment in the first place? To revive a foreign judgment, the same way we recognize how a foreign judgment is entered under foreign laws, we all have to also recognize and honor how foreign judgments are revived. They're not revived under the procedures, under Colorado rules and procedures. They're revived under Arizona law. Again, I think this comes back down to, do we have a one-judgment approach or two-judgment approach? I think we have a one-judgment approach based on bound. And I think that's what the Uniform Act was intending, was to give full faith and credit to the one judgment and to honor and recognize that foreign judgment. If you go to the two-judgment approach, which, and I think the Court of Appeals gets confused. I think sometimes they're writing the one-judgment approach, and then sometimes they jump over to the two-judgment approach. And I think they further muddy the water, which needs to be clarified here. But if you went with a two-judgment approach, and some states have done this, if you go to the two-judgment approach, what they're saying is, we'll recognize the foreign judgment at the time that you domesticate it. And then when you domesticate it, then we don't have to think about that anymore. We just go to a brand new judgment in Colorado. We just ignore that. Well, my response to that are a couple. As to this case, there wasn't any law that said that at the time. The law that was before Wells Fargo didn't say that we have a brand new judgment and to ignore the foreign judgment. It said, in fact, you've got to go there and you've got to go revive that judgment, because in Colorado, even though judgments were good for 20 years, a transcript of judgment is only good for 6 years. And so you have to go from the day of that judgment to enter. So if we're in a two-judgment approach, if we did decide to adopt that, and if the court wanted to go forward and say, we don't want these problems, the way to simplify this would be to go the two-judgment approach, then what you're giving up, what you're giving up is you're giving up the full faith and credit to that foreign judgment. In some cases, you're going to be creating a more powerful judgment than that foreign judgment wanted. In some cases, you're going to be creating a less of a judgment. For example, Arizona. Arizona has a judgment that's like this for 5 years. Colorado, we're good for 20. If we're going to say we're going to ignore Arizona once that gets domesticated and then go forward, then in fact what we could do is we could wait 4.5 years, we could domesticate over here, we could ignore the foreign judgment. Now we have a new judgment for 20. We wait for 19 years. We could loop back down around Arizona. We could domesticate down there. We can just do kind of an internal loop. Plus, what you're doing when you're doing that is, under Colorado law, it says you can't go more than 6 years on an initial transcript unless you renew or revive. And in this case, you'd be given that Arizona judgment even more power than what the Colorado law wanted to do. But other states have looked at that and said, wow, this is kind of confusing. This is hard to figure out how you do that. How do you honor full faith and credit, yet at the same time get some uniformity in what's going on? And for example, in Oklahoma, they had a similar case of Baum, and they called it the Riggs case. And the Riggs case said the same thing. You look to the foreign judgment for applicable statute of running of the judgment. And they reversed that case. They came back and said, you know, In the efforts of trying to make more uniform law and how we enforce judgments here, we're now going to ignore that. And so they reversed bound. I'm not saying that that's the best approach to take, but if we do need further guidance and clarification, and if one approach is to go that route, then this court would have to reverse Baum and say, we're no longer going to look at the foreign judgment to count from there. There's a couple other approaches we could also do to try to clarify this. One would be to go to what the Court of Appeals did. But the Court of Appeals is actually creating, and they were somewhat confusing. They first said, one, maybe you don't need to go back to Arizona. And I think that's just flat out not correct. I think that the case law that is the law of Colorado says differently. But then they come back and say, well, all right, if you do need to go down there, go down to Arizona and revive, then come back up here and re-domesticate or domesticate in the same action and then get a new transcript, because we're not going to recognize the transcript of Arizona. So therefore, that's what you need to do. As to this case, the statute doesn't say that. The statute doesn't say go and revive your judgment and then re-domesticate. It doesn't say that. It says go down and revive your judgment and file a transcript of judgment. Well, the respondents make a big deal that, hey, this is not a, quote, transcript of judgment. This is a renewal affidavit. And this renewal affidavit is not a transcript of judgment. What is a transcript of judgment? There is no specific definition in Colorado what a transcript of judgment is. It's evidence of the judgment. In Arizona, the evidence of the judgment is this renewal affidavit. The second point that the respondents try to make on this is, well, what you're doing is you're taking a foreign document and you're creating a Colorado lien. No, we're not. The lien was created when it was domesticated under the Uniform Act in the Colorado action, and then that transcript of judgment was recorded. What we're doing is renewing that lien pursuant to how the statute told us to do. And what is the purpose of the renewal? What the legislature did not want to have happen here is for you to tie up real estate for 20 years. Even though we're going to give you 20 years to try to enforce a judgment, as to real estate, we want real estate to be marketable and transferable. And so what we're going to do is we're going to say, if you don't move in that first 6 years, we're going to make you come back and revive that judgment, move that judgment date back up, and then we'll give you another 6 years. But you've got to always be within 6 years of the judgment date or the revival date. That is what the purpose was. So the purpose was accomplished in what Wells Fargo did. Wells Fargo gave notice to the world, gave notice to the debtor, that in fact it was their intent to keep this judgment lien in place. And in fact, one of the things we need to do if we decide how we want to clarify this is we got to figure out what we're going to do with transcripts of judgments, especially in foreign judgment proceedings. Because right now, this renewal affidavit, as far as trying to provide notice to the world of what our intent is, actually gives more information and better information than a typical transcript of judgment in Colorado. The renewal affidavit actually showed the date of the Arizona judgment, showed the date of the Colorado domestication, showed the date of the original recording of the transcript of judgment in that county, and said this was renewing it. Our transcripts of judgments that are issued out now, the one that was originally filed in 1999, basically shows the amount of the judgment, the parties, and the date. And the date that they use right now, they don't even use the foreign judgment date. They use the domestication date, which flies completely in the face of the Baum case. Because the Baum case says you go to the foreign judgment.
Could I just interrupt you? And I guess I understand, of course, what you're saying, but it would make sense on a certain level, wouldn't it, from a due process perspective, if Colorado has this rule 54, to require someone who wants to enforce a judgment that was obtained in another state to comply with our Colorado sense of due process, which could be notice and hearing. And that seems to be what the rule is suggesting, right?
Yeah.
Now you say, well, that requirement really shouldn't be honored. One, it came into existence before the uniform statute, and two, the uniform statute just makes a whole lot more sense. And why should we have this sort of state-by-state sense of due process? Arizona is every bit as good as Colorado in terms of its due process. Just skip that step, right? I mean, isn't that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess...
I know I'm oversimplifying, of course, but...
No, I guess what I'm saying is 54H applies to Colorado judgments. I understand, and our point is, this is not a Colorado judgment, but I understand you've got to look at how you enforce in Colorado law, so I understand the argument. But it's inconsistent with the Uniform Act. I mean, the Uniform Act said, here's a simple process in which you domesticate a judgment. You simply file it, and you send notice out. Now, if we come and say, all right, but if you want to revive that same judgment, now we're going to have tougher standards, you're going to, and that's what 54H would create, was tougher standards and what the Act would do, then what you're doing is you're undermining. I mean, the purpose of the Uniform Act was not to clog up the courts with all of these new actions to create new judgments in Colorado. What they said is, we want judicial economy, save the courts congestion. What you're going to do, if we now say that, is creditors coming into Colorado are going to say, you know, it'd be easier if we just bring the action in the first place, because then we can go ahead and do that. But that's not what we have now. And again, I'm not here to say that things are clear. I'm here to say that the law that was before Wells Fargo at the time, they complied with it. And to the extent that this court found that they didn't comply with it, they substantially complied with it. And they served the purpose of giving notice to the world what was going on. And there's a lot of argument here that the respondents make, well, this is not something you can have substantial compliance on. This is a strict compliance.
So you're saying the law is confused, but at the very least, Wells Fargo ought to be able to enforce its judgment?
Yes, yes. In fact, the judgment which was assigned to Ms. Kaufman, yes.
Right.
That's pretty much the theme that I have. And I think going forward, though, this gives an opportunity for this court to clear it up. And there's one of three approaches that I see at how the court could clear it up. Do the two-judgment approach, which is, I think, new law. It would require you to reverse bound. I think you run into problems of full faith and credit. If you do that, when you start to ignore, because we can, in effect, then be enforcing the Colorado judgment in where the foreign judgment is no longer enforceable. So there'd be no requirement to go in and revive the old judgment in the other state. There's problems with that, but a lot of states have said, you know what, that's just what we're going to do because it's easier. That's one approach. The other approach is to keep with the one judgment approach, pretty much what Wells Fargo did, and perhaps outline through a rule what are the requirements for that transcript of judgment. What does that transcript of judgment has to have to give notice to the world? The third approach is the Court of Appeals, and frankly, I have a problem with the Court of Appeals the best I understand it, because it's creating more steps than one would have to take when they originally domesticated the judgment. It just doesn't make sense. We would, in effect, be undermining and repealing the Uniform Act because nobody would want to follow it.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
I'm still having a little trouble seeing the policy argument that I think you've alluded to a few times in the Uniform Act, because it seems to me you're conceding or agreeing that the Uniform Act clearly requires domestication of a foreign judgment in order for it to become a lien.
Yes.
in this state, and yet for some policy reasons you're suggesting that the Uniform Act did not intend you to re-domesticate or revive judgment. Is that right?
I don't think that. I think the Uniform Act didn't specifically address how do you revive it, but if you're consistent with the Uniform Act, the original domestication should have provided your ability to enforce in the state of Colorado. And the fact that you go down and revive in Arizona, you shouldn't have to come back and re-domesticate. Because think in mind what the purpose of why we're reviving. The purpose why we're reviving is to extend that judgment lien. So we're talking about the 1999 transcript of judgment. That's the one that's in place. That's the one we're trying to renew. How do you come back? How do you come back? If you come back under a new domestication, then you're not going to have any connection with the first domesticated action. So how are you going to connect that transcript that way? If you come back under the old one, how are you going to reference the judgment dates? Because right now, under our transcripts of judgment, they don't even reference the Arizona judgment date.
See, I'm not sure I understand that. It seems to me that at least the logical strain for re-domesticating a revived judgment would seem to be very much the same as for having to domesticate a foreign judgment in the first place. In effect, it's a recognition by our jurisdiction, isn't it, that this judgment exists and therefore has effect in our jurisdiction. If that judgment would expire in its own jurisdiction, then presumably we wouldn't give it force and effect. But if we felt obliged to recognize the validity of that judgment to give it force and effect in this jurisdiction in the first place, why wouldn't we logically want to have to recognize the revival as having force and effect?
If we're going to do that, we're going to have to somehow set forth rules on how the new domestication will connect to the first domestication in the judgment lien that was created. And my only response to that, and I understand the court's point, that's not what the law currently says. The law does not say that. 1352.102 does not say that. It says you simply revive the judgment, file a transcript, which we argue is evidence of that judgment in the county. If we do want to go that path, we need to outline that so people have a clear picture of what they want to do. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Stephen Hess. I'm with the firm of Sherman and Howard. Seated at counsel table with me, is Mr. James Lester, who is co-counsel on this case, and in the audience, William Lynn Kaufman, who is one of the respondents. If you go down to the law library and take out the 1877 Code of Civil Procedure, there's some quaint language in sections we probably wouldn't understand. Like section 74 starts off by talking about, if a demur heard invocation shall be sustained at the hearing. It takes some work to understand that language. On the other hand, if you flip forward in the 1877 Code of Civil Procedure to the section on revival, you would find that the statute, or this statutorily authorized Code of Civil Procedure, says a judgment in a civil action may be revived by filing a petition in the action, alleging the time judgment was rendered, and then it goes on. It is stunningly similar to current Rule 54H, and that's not a mistake. The legislature promulgated in 1877 at the first territorial legislative sessions a Code of Civil Procedure that provided for the revival of judgments in a very specific manner that effectively has never changed in 133 years. In 1941, when the legislature authorized the Supreme Court to make rules, it did so with the provision that the Supreme Court couldn't change the rights of litigants. And when it adopted Rule 54H, it effectively took the language straight out of the Code of Civil Procedure, together with an adjacent code section, and made it the law of revival throughout the state. You heard suggestions from the petitioner in this case that the Supreme Court's task is to do something by way of policy to fashion a statewide comprehensive revival system. The respondents disagree. We think your responsibility is to interpret the statutes as promulgated by the legislature. And I think if you interpret the statutes promulgated by the legislature, you will note that although there may be some initial plausibility to read 1352.102 in the manner that the petitioner suggests, if that's all you're looking at, all of that plausibility goes away when you try to walk through the actual language of the statutes we're dealing with and see the numerous inconsistencies, lack of clarity, and problems that the reading suggested by the petitioner would accomplish. Let's start with where I think we need to start, and that is the revival law of 54H has been around for 133 years.
Mr. Hess, actually, it would be very helpful to me if you just walked us through this statute, 1352.102, and explain how it works as you have concluded. You've indicated that a reading of it is confused the way they read it, and that you're merely asking for the plain meaning of it. So perhaps you should walk us through it.
Thank you, Your Honor. With your permission, I would like to start with one sentence from 1353-103, which is the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, because I think it's relevant. And that's the last sentence, and it says, with regard to a foreign judgment filed, it, quote, has the same effect and is subject to the same procedures, defenses, and proceedings for reopening, vacating, or staying as a judgment of the court of this state in which filed and may be enforced or satisfied in like manner. Turning then to the statute at issue, the statute at issue is somewhat lengthy, but I'll read through it first, and then I would like to go over four particular phrases that I think govern interpretation. Subsection 1 says, all goods and chattels, land, tenements, and real estate of every person against whom any judgment is obtained in any court of record in this state, either at law or in equity, or against whom any foreign judgment is filed with the clerk of any court of this state in accordance with the provisions of the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act. Then it continues, a transcript of the judgment record of such judgment, and I'll note it says a transcript of the judgment record of such judgment certified by the clerk of such court may be recorded in any county, and from the time of recording such transcript and not before, the judgment shall become a lien upon all the real estate not exempt from execution in the county where such transcript of judgment is recorded, owned by such judgment debtor or which such judgment debtor may afterwards acquire in such county until such lien expires. The lien of such judgment shall expire 6 years after the entry of judgment unless, prior to the expiration of such 6-year period, such judgment is revived as provided by law, and a transcript of the judgment record of such revived judgment, certified by the clerk of the court in which such revived judgment was entered, is recorded in the same county in which the transcript of the original judgment was recorded, in which event the lien shall continue for 6 years from the entry of the revived judgment. A lien may be obtained with respect to a revived judgment in the same manner as an original judgment, and the lien of a revived judgment may be continued in the same manner as the lien of an original judgment. The lien of any judgment shall expire if the judgment is satisfied or considered as satisfied as provided in this section. So the question then is, how do you go about reviving a judgment? And I will note that the phrase, judgment is revived as provided by law, specifies that you revive the judgment as provided by law and suggest you look elsewhere, which I believe is Rule 54H. That is confirmed, by the way, if you go on to look at subsection 2 that doesn't have anything to do with renewing a judgment lien. It just says if you want to revive a judgment before the expiration of 20 years, then you have to make sure that it is revived as provided by law. Now, I am reading as provided by law in subsection 2 to mean exactly the same thing as provided by law in subsection 1. If the petitioner's argument is correct, revived as provided by law in subsection 1 means either in Colorado or in the foreign state, while the phrase as provided by law in subsection 2 can only refer to Colorado. And so at the outset, the phrase judgment is revived as provided by law, the phrase revived as provided by law, unambiguously refers to Rule 54H.
Mr. Hess, yes. I think that's a good argument to make it, but isn't it equally a good argument that the word judgment means two different things if you accept the bound definition of judgment? So you're stuck with kind of a confusing...
No, sir, and I say
not,
no...
If not, why not? Explain to me.
I say no, sir, because... 1352-102 subsection 2A, and I only read part, says, except as provided in paragraph B of this subsection 2, execution may issue on any judgment described in subsection 1. You cannot issue execution on an Arizona judgment. Subsection 2 absolutely has to refer to a Colorado judgment, because execution only issues on a Colorado judgment.
But the statute runs consistent with the date of the Arizona judgment rather than Colorado judgment, right?
Your Honor, I think Baum may be mistaken, but I don't think we have to reach the issue of whether Baum is mistaken or
so
not.
So we have two different words for judgment, the references for judgment. Let me ask another.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt your
time. Well, I guess what I want to ask you is, does it make sense to say that the revival of a foreign judgment is, once it's properly domesticated, it should be easier, you know, than it was initially to do it?
I mean, no, Your Honor.
Okay, and if not, why not?
And ironically, I think one of the teachings of Baum on which the petitioner relies, although I don't necessarily agree with its construction, one thing Baum says is you can't treat outside creditors better than inside creditors. And that's why Baum came to the decision it did. Ironically, what the petitioner is saying is, even though Colorado plaintiffs and creditors have to go through 54H, we think the Arizona creditors deserve a break. They shouldn't have to give notice. They shouldn't have to have 10 days. They shouldn't have a hearing. They should be able to use an easier mechanism for reviving external, extra-jurisdictional judgments than is provided for.
Well, isn't the theory behind that, though, Mr. Hess, that Arizona has provided its own due process and there shouldn't have to be a duplicate or a secondary form of due process in Colorado?
Your Honor, I believe that's true, except if that is true, then Baum's decision is anchored on a faulty premise.
I understand that. But let me, if Justice Bender's finished with his line of questions, let me change, if I may. So why don't you think that 1353-103 basically almost just resolves this issue?
I think 1353-103 does, Your Honor.
Okay.
And this
could
is
you talk to me about that, please?
Yes, it's my first chance to reply or to respond to a reply brief in which the petitioners correctly noted I truncated the quote and then I underlined it, and the result was I didn't get across exactly what I wanted to, but what 1353-103 says, I think unambiguously, is that you treat a foreign judgment for all practical purposes as a state judgment once it has been entered. And if you take a look, what it says is, a judgment so filed has the same effect and is subject to the same procedures, defenses, and proceedings for reopening, vacating, or staying as a judgment of the court of this state in which filed, and may be enforced or satisfied in like manner. Now, I'll tell you that when the legislature adopted this from the Uniform Act, it looks like they muffed the language that talks about a judgment of the court of this state in which filed. But that part aside, there's no dispute about that. The petitioner says, just a minute, the respondent in this case has tried to truncate this because we believe that this section only deals with reopening, vacating, or staying a judgment. It has nothing to do with revival. My response to that is twofold. I read it as saying the same procedures as a judgment, the same defenses as a judgment, and the same proceedings for reopening, vacating, or staying as a judgment. If that's where the language ended, we might have an ambiguity. But the last phrase, I think, resolves the ambiguity very clearly, because it says a judgment filed in Colorado, quote, may be enforced or satisfied in like manner, period, close quote, which I think says you treat it as a Colorado judgment. And the question the petitioner asked, which is, in essence, well, what were we supposed to do when we have Baum in front of us and we thought that a different procedure was to be utilized? My suggestion is that if they had looked at Griggs versus Gibson, and they may have, but Griggs versus Gibson, decided by the Court of Appeals in 1988, I don't think leaves any question about what the law was. I'm quoting from the opinion. It says, the filing of a foreign judgment under the procedure established by the Act is not the institute of an action. It is a step designed to convert a foreign judgment into a domestic judgment. It doesn't say to preserve a foreign judgment as an enforceable entity in some jurisprudential ontology. It says it converts it into a domestic judgment. The opinion goes on to say, and this is 1988, The filing of the authenticated copy of the foreign judgment is not a mere administrative step that may be waived. It is, rather, the equivalent of the entry of an original judgment by the domestic court, and thus is a necessary condition precedent to the domestic enforcement of that judgment. Turning back to 1352-102, again, understanding the initial plausibility or at least potential desirability of resolving the one word entry of judgment, there are several other phrases that are thrown into chaos by the interpretation suggested by the petitioners. I mentioned revised as provided by law. I'm sorry, revised as provided by law must mean 54H or subsection 2 makes no sense. The second phrase is transcript of judgment record, and the petitioner consistently referred to this as transcript of judgment. That's not what the statute says. The statute says transcript of judgment record, and that's vital, because when the statute was originally enacted, there was no such thing as a transcript of judgment record. It was a transcript of the judgment docket as provided by 1877. And the rule for revival talked about a transcript of the judgment docket. And so this isn't some vague phrase that the Court of Appeals invoked with indefinite meaning. It is, at least in my view, it's absolutely clearly a reflection of the rules and the manner in which judgments get entered. Rule 79 used to say judgment docket. And when Rule 79 said judgment docket, the statute said transcript of judgment docket. The rule was changed to say judgment record about 30 years ago, and eventually in 2002, when other arcane language dealing with federal circuit courts was taken out, this statute was changed to say transcript of judgment record. And if you look at the history of the statute, the phrase transcript of judgment record has an absolute meaning. It's Rule 79D, and that is the record of the state clerk of court in Colorado reflecting a judgment. If you try to read transcript of judgment alone, then it's understandable that you might not link those together, but they absolutely ought to be linked together, because the amendment clearly was intended to make sure that the language utilized in the statute was consistent with the language that was utilized in the rule regarding revival. Another phrase that's used in 1352-102 is original judgment recorded, and it appears in a couple of places. It talks about reviving a lien and then recording the transcript of judgment record in the same county in which the transcript of the original judgment was recorded. Now, if you are to understand petitioner's argument that when you talk about the original judgment, you're talking about the foreign judgment under this dichotomy that we don't agree with, that if their argument is persuasive and you treat the phrase original judgment as meaning a foreign judgment, then this language literally tells you you revive a judgment by recording it in Arizona. And that makes no sense. The phrase, the transcript of the original judgment was recorded, must refer to the state in which the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act filing was made, and then the transcript was originally recorded. The same phrase, original judgment, is used in the next sentence. The lien of a revived judgment may be continued in the same manner as the lien of an original judgment. The theory that the original judgment is the Arizona judgment doesn't make sense. It's the domesticated judgment whose lien continues. Finally, if you look at the phrase, the clerk of the court, the phrase clerk of the court is used many times in this statute. And if you read it, the initial sentence says, a UEFJA judgment is filed, quote, with the clerk of any court of this state, close quote. Then you get a transcript of the judgment record of the judgment, quote, certified by the clerk of such court, which refers to this state. Then you go on, and there's a phrase talking about a transcript of the judgment record of the revived judgment. And again, transcript of judgment record refers to a Colorado court's entry on a docket under 79D. It goes on to say that a transcript of the judgment record of such revived judgment certified by the clerk of the court in which such revived judgment was entered. We construe that as referring to the Colorado clerk, not as an Arizona clerk. Accordingly, if you read through the literal language of 1352.102, whatever initial plausibility there might be to find some ambiguity, as Baum did, the remainder of 1352.102 requires that it be read as invoking the procedures of Rule 54H regarding revival. What are some of the ramifications if you accept the interpretation proposed by the petitioner? Well, the petitioner has suggested that there are two different kinds of judgments, foreign judgments and Colorado judgments. In fact, if you accept the petitioner's position, there are at least three. One is a Colorado judgment. The second is a foreign judgment that's filed in Colorado. And the third is a foreign judgment that becomes a Colorado judgment because an independent action is filed. You can still file, under the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, you can still file an independent action and get a foreign judgment confirmed in Colorado. And you might say to yourself, why would anybody do that if they just have to file? And I think the answer is, look at the record in this case. Amazingly, this case started with a petition for registration of a foreign judgment. There is no such thing as a petition for registration of a foreign judgment. Whether it was supposed to have been started as a civil action or merely as a civil filing with the clerk without the court's participation isn't entirely clear. Wells Fargo may have decided to adopt a belt and suspenders approach and say, we're going to file an action and we're going to file all the necessary papers. I'm not telling you their papers are inadequate, but I'm telling you that if you look at this record, they very well may have obtained what is really an independent judgment. If you understand that there can be independent judgments, then the procedures under subsection 1 that they're referring to don't apply. If you get an independent judgment without filing, everything they've used to try to rely on the distinction between entering and filing is irrelevant to that judgment. And that means if you're a foreign judgment creditor and you, quote, filed, close quote, your foreign judgment, you would adopt one revival procedure according to petitioners. But if you actually got a judgment by going through the court, you treat it just like a Colorado judgment. That doesn't seem to make any sense. But what seems to make even less sense to me is the entire argument on which they base their interpretation occurs in connection with the extension of a lien. Imagine that Wells Fargo didn't want to extend a lien. It just wanted to revive its judgment. Where would you look? The answer is 1352.102 subsection 2. And that says to revive a judgment before the end of 20 periods to make sure it's still good, you follow the procedures as provided by law, which is 54H. That means that under petitioner's interpretation, you would follow one procedure for revival if you wanted to extend a lien, and a completely different procedure for revival if all you wanted to do was extend the judgment itself.
I actually didn't understand that. Could you go over that again? Could you just say that again?
Yes, Your Honor. Let's imagine that there were no question in this case about wanting to extend the lien. That is, Wells Fargo was merely concerned that the 20 years was running out, no lien was at issue at all, and Wells Fargo said to itself, what do we do in order to revive the judgment so that it's good for more than 20 years? Nothing in 1352.102 subsection 1 tells you. Where you would look is 1352.102 subsection 2, and what it says is, except as provided in paragraph B of this subsection 2, execution may issue on any judgment described in subsection 1, which I take to be an original judgment or a foreign judgment. Execution may issue on any judgment described in subsection 1 of this section to enforce the same at any time within 20 years from the entry thereof, but not afterwards, unless revived as provided by law. Unless revived as provided by law, and after 20 years from the entry of final judgment in any court of this state, the judgment shall be considered as satisfied in full unless so revived. And so Wells Fargo would read subsection 2 and say, I have to get this revived as provided by law. What does the phrase "as provided by law" mean? It can't mean subsection 1, because that only deals with the extension of judgment liens. It doesn't deal with revival generally. The only other place to find the revival law is the same place you would have looked in 1877, which is in the Civil Procedure Code, or in this case, Rule 54H. And so what the petitioners are saying is, if all Wells Fargo wanted to do was to revive the judgment for another 20 years, they'd have to follow 54H. But because they wanted to extend the lien, they can trade on this alleged ambiguity in subsection 1 and use a shortcut procedure by going through the Arizona courts, where they merely file an affidavit. With regard to enforceability in general, you've been presented with a dichotomy under which the petitioners suggest that if you read all the cases around the country, you will see two kinds of courts, those who treat it as two judgments and those who treat it as one. I don't think the dichotomy is accurate. I think it's perfectly appropriate to suggest courts don't need to adopt one or the other. There are certain procedural defenses to the enforcement of a judgment. It doesn't mean you necessarily respect two judgments. And let me just give you one example. The petitioner has suggested that unenforceability in a foreign state may be a defense. And it may well be a defense, but that doesn't mean you treat it as two judgments in Colorado. That means there's an affirmative defense that's applicable to it, namely, it was unenforceable in the original state. I don't think you have to reach that question. It's not raised here about whether it was enforceable in Arizona, and I don't think you need to reach it as a matter of statutory interpretation. I mention that only because I think it's a false dichotomy. I don't think the court has to adopt one or the other. I think what the court can say is, the law of Colorado is, you must follow Rule 54H to revive the judgment. And if somebody says, well, wait, that can't be right. What if it's unenforceable in the original jurisdiction? The answer, as the Court of Appeals said, is, we've only told you what's necessary. We've told you it's necessary to follow Rule 54H. We haven't told you that it's sufficient. Enforceability in the foreign state might be a defense. The petitioners might have to go back to Arizona to make sure it continues to be enforceable there.
So you're saying that's the whole point of Rule 54's requirement for an objection in a hearing? At least one of the points?
That's at least one of the points, Your Honor, because the petitioners point out 54H has been around for 100 years before the Uniform Enforcement. And the 10-day hearing is to give a debtor an opportunity to say, wait, before you tie up my property, maybe it's been satisfied, waived, relinquished, initially void, or something like that. The suggestion that the court would impose burdensome procedures for redomestication and revival, I also think is incorrect. And the reason I think it's incorrect is that I don't think there's any requirement that a creditor who has obtained foreign judgment recorded in Colorado, either by filing or by going through a court action, necessarily has to go back and revive it in its original state if it's still good. If you have a judgment that is entered in a state, and under that state's law, it's good for 10 years, when it comes time to revive it in Colorado, I don't think you have to go back and revive it in the original state. It's still a valid judgment, not subject to a defense that is no longer valid. I think what the revival statute says is you have to revive whatever Colorado judgment you got so that you get a new transcript of the judgment record reflecting that you went through the revival procedures in Colorado. And so when the petitioners say, wait, you're imposing a requirement that it be redomesticated, that you revive it, that you go through two different procedures, the answer may be yes, if you're going to lose the enforceability in the original state, absolutely. By the same token, it's not required. If the original judgment is still enforceable in another state, you just come to Colorado and revive it. And you revive it according to 1352.102, which refers to revived as provided by law that takes you to 54H. You file a motion for reviver. You give 10 days notice to the judgment debtor. If the judgment debtor doesn't say anything, then an order of reviver is issued, and you record the order of reviver and give the world notice that you followed Colorado procedures. If what the court is worried about is practical application, and it's worried about making judgment creditors go through perhaps a small additional hoop. I suggest that the petitioner's argument would require 50 different ways of renewing judgments. That is, instead of telling everybody in the state of Colorado, including the people who rely, the non-lawyers who rely on these things, like title companies, instead of giving them uniform methods under Rule 54H to determine when a judgment's been revived and what they have to look at, in effect, what you'd be saying is, there are 50 different ways to revive judgments in Colorado, one for every state. And if you have a judgment from Minnesota, the way to revive it in Colorado is to go through whatever procedures Minnesota requires, and then bring an order from that court, or just an affidavit if they don't have orders, or some sort of record if they don't have a judgment record itself, and record it in the real property records in Colorado. Once you've recorded it and given some sort of notice to the world that you had a judgment in Minnesota, you send title examiners, attorneys, debtors, everybody scrambling to Minnesota to find out whether you even filed or followed the Minnesota revival procedures. I suggest that that is much more cumbersome and much more difficult than a simple rule that says, if you want to enforce a judgment in Colorado, you must do what every Colorado judgment creditor must do. Why? Because your foreign judgment under 1353-103 can be enforced as a like judgment in Colorado. It can be enforced or satisfied in like manner. Enforced or satisfied in like manner doesn't mean you use a different state's procedures. It means you use the procedures that are provided for 133 years in Colorado. If there are no further questions, I appreciate your time.
I'll try to be brief. Respondent cites the Griggs case, and I'd want to point out to the court that, again, this is another point that we have confusing law out there. The Griggs case seems to find the face of the Baum case. The Baum case, which was issued after the Griggs case, is also cited by this Supreme Court. And that adds to some of the confusion, because the Baum case basically finds differently. We hear a lot of discussion from the respondent, the Court of Appeals, on how you read 1352-102. And I think there's problems there. And part of the problem is that statute is to revive judgments and judgment liens, not only on Colorado judgments that were originated in Colorado, but also foreign judgments which are being enforced in Colorado. So there is some confusion there, because they are referencing how you do it on Colorado judgments to begin with, and how you're going to do with foreign judgments. So there needs to be some clarification. Baum tried to clarify that. Baum came in and said, hey, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to help you out on the foreign judgment here and how you read 1352-102. I'm going to tell you that when you're counting that 6 years and when you're talking about where a judgment is entered, you're talking foreign jurisdiction. And it is from the Baum trying to attempt to clarify 1352-102 is where Wells Fargo went and revived the judgment. The other point that is made by the respondent is, gee, they should revive it under 54H. Well, 54H applies to Colorado judgments, not to foreign judgments. 54H, in the very definition of the rule to begin with, talks about judgments and decrees which can be appealed in this court. We're talking a foreign judgment. In addition, under 54H, it does limit, as the respondent acknowledges, it does limit to the reopening and staying and vacating the judgment. It doesn't talk about judgment renewal. It doesn't talk about revival of the judgment. The other point is that the respondent makes is, well, gee, this is unfair to the other Colorado judgments, because you're going to allow these people to revive the judgments under easier law. No. We're going to make them revive it under the law in which they obtained the judgment to begin with, which was Arizona. And it might be tougher to revive in Arizona than Colorado. It might be easier. But you're going to go the same way you gave full faith and credit to the original judgment. You're going to still give full faith and credit on the fact that they've revived it according to those laws. The point that we need to get back to is there is confusion here. there is confusion here. But what Wells Fargo did was that they took the law as they could best understand it, and they complied with it. And they met what the goal was. The goal is to notify the parties and notify all interested parties that the intent was to keep that judgment lien afloat. That renewal affidavit contains even more information than a typical transcript of judgment. If this court wants to set forth new guidelines on what has to be done, if in fact, Your Honor, if this court wants to say, we want you to revive that and then come back to this state and either file a new domestication or go back in the same domestication, then we should say that. We should let all people know what's going on. And if we're going to go that far, we should also state what that transfer to justice is going to state. Because right now we have confusion. Right now, even under the original 1999 transcript of justice that the lien is based upon, it references the domestication date. It doesn't reference the Arizona date, so it's confusing to begin with. We need to clarify for future people coming down the road on how they're going to redo this. And I think it just comes back to the fact that what we have is some confusion. But here, in this particular case, Wells Fargo pursued the law as best they could see it. And to find for the respondent would, in essence, operate as a windfall in favor of the respondent against the petitioner here on alleged technicality. The purpose of the statute was complied with. We gave due process, and the creditor was diligent. This isn't a situation where the creditor sat on their thumbs and then tried to come back and resurrect. The law seems to favor people who are diligent in their actions, and this is what happened here. I thank you for your time.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.